Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In September of 1971, prisoners at the Attica Correctional Facility rose up in rebellion and took control of the maximum security prison. They would hold it for 4 days while negotiating for fundamental changes to improve their living conditions. But the standoff ended in tragedy. New York State troopers stormed Attica and opened fire, killing dozens of people, including both inmates and the prison guards who were being held hostage. It was a shocking and violent end to a story that had captured the nation's attention and shed light on the suffering inside America's prisons. But even though the TV crews soon left Attica, the story didn't end. The inmates suffered violent reprisals for the uprising, and for decades, New York's state government worked to cover up the truth about what had happened at Attica. My guest today is Heather Ann Thompson, a professor at the University of Michigan and author of Blood in the Water, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the history of Attica. We'll discuss the troubling aftermath of the uprising after New York's government took back control of the prison. We'll look at the state's control of the narrative and how for 5 decades it has suppressed the truth. Our conversation is next. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. Heather Ann Thompson, welcome to American Scandal.
So great to be here.
In our series, we looked at the 4-day standoff at Attica, but also the chaotic siege that ended the standoff. We've told most of that story, but the siege itself was where things really went off the rails. So I wondered if we could focus on that day, those hours. And I was wondering if you could describe as best you can in detail what happened when the New York State troopers stormed the prison.
Wow. Well, you know, it really kind of depends on from where you're sitting what happened. For the men who woke up that morning, it was a cold, rainy, chilly morning, but it was a morning that was very much like all the others that had come before it. Every morning, they kind of expected that negotiations would continue. That morning, they had met at the gate with representatives from the Department of Corrections who had said the same thing that they said every morning, which is, you know, it's time to release the hostages and surrender and let's give up. We're done now. And they said, no, we are not going to give up. We believe that negotiations should continue. And it was only after a few moments that it began to dawn that, you know, things were not exactly quite the same. There was the catwalks above were largely clear. There was no troopers looking down on them with guns sighted as there had been on days before. And it, you know, it was a little eerie because there had been no observers that had been there, and it was kind of weirdly quiet. And then they had seen a helicopter pass over, and for the first moment, there was a bit of elation because I think they thought that maybe Rockefeller was coming. You know, a bit of a cheer goes up. Maybe he's going to come. Maybe he's going to finally endorse the idea that they could surrender when it was time without reprisals, without injury. And then it disappears, and then they get really, really scared. Prisoners are terrified. The hostages are terrified because they know in that moment that all of this is going to hinge on whether or not the state of New York, in fact, values their own state employees' lives and will resist the temptation to send their state troopers in with guns blazing. And of course, they can't resist that temptation.
Was it a temptation or was it a plan? How did the state response, so violent and immediate, happen? Was it something that was deliberate?
Well, of course, it is both. The deepest misconceptions that people had for many decades about Attica was that the state went in because they had no choice, because they had bargained in good faith, but in the 11th hour, they had no choice but to go in. And what we now know is that that is not true, and that they had, in fact, always planned on going in, and that the only reason they hadn't gone in earlier, frankly, was that the prisoners had invited these very high-profile observers in, including, you know, U.S. congressmen, state senators, and it was the very presence of the media and those high-profile observers and the fact that the world was watching that undoubtedly had stalled it for as long as it did. So yes, it was a plan. And the fact that they sent in these kind of low-level troopers, one could argue that that was also part of the plan. Because when it went wrong and when such carnage could happen, there could also be maximum deniability.
The troopers rush in. Violence ensues. Prisoners break into chaos and terror. How long does it take the state to take back control of the prison after 4 days of standoff?
Well, what's really remarkable is that the actual retaking of this facility is immediate. The state of New York sends in first this reconnaissance helicopter, and then immediately this huge chopper that drops the CN gas and CS gas over the yard, which people need to understand, gas is, you know, in some respects, a misnomer. It's a powder, and it clings to people's mucous membranes, and it literally fells everyone in the yard. They are vomiting. They're choking. In many respects, order was taken the moment that gas was dropped, but that wasn't enough. So then they send in hundreds of these state troopers, and not just the state troopers. We need to be aware that, you know, later testimony made clear that the Genesee Sheriff's Department felt that they had also been invited in, and Parks Police felt that they had been invited in willingly. Corrections officers from other facilities were there, everyone with their own personal weapons and state issue weapons. And in the first literally 15 minutes of this shooting spree, order is more than restored. People are on the ground. They are severely wounded. 128 men are shot, hostages and prisoners alike, some of them multiple times. Order is well restored. Half an hour later, hours later, they can still hear gunshots. And we know that people are still being killed after order is restored. And we know that people are being tortured after order is restored. So the question of order being restored is no longer part of this equation, actually. It is now a question of retribution. It is now a question of vengeance. And what we really need to understand is that everybody on the scene knew that this would happen. And in fact, the governor himself was told that this was going to happen in no uncertain terms. He was told that this would be a massacre if he sent in these troopers. And his own advisors, including very highly ranked military advisors, General O'Hara, had said to him, if you send in this kind of an armed retaking, your own state employees will be killed. There will be this kind of result, and he did it anyway.
So in a horrifying and brief 15 minutes, the prison is retaken. What did the public know about what was happening?
Well, this is, again, the layer upon layer of tragedies of Attica is that the public knows nothing. The public is actively lied to. The state officials stand out in front of the prison and they tell the American public, the world public, incidentally, because there are media there from, you know, that are reporting effectively around the world, that something entirely different took place than what took place. They say that the prisoners are the ones who killed the hostages, which is not what happened. Not only did they kill the hostages, but they actively maimed one of the hostages. They killed some of the hostages prior even to the retaking and had buried them in the yard, things that just literally did not happen. And this story becomes a headline in the paper of record, the New York Times, the LA Times, myriad papers across the country. And so what they did learn was an outright lie that effectively guts what had been very, very favorable and growingly favorable sentiment for prisoner rights in the country. But other than that, they don't know anything. Meanwhile, that is assuredly going to continue because the troopers, the same troopers who have been in charge of retaking the prison, are now in charge of investigating what happened. So no chalk markings are made of bodies where they fell. Weapons are disappeared. Photographs are doctored. Film is spliced. You name it. And then meanwhile, the governor's office is getting its story straight with the heads of the police. And thus the cover-up begins. But nobody is aware that this is happening and frankly will not be aware of the depth of the cover-up for 45 years.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
I'd like you to speculate a bit about why the media failed to dig into the story deeper. I mean, they were camped out. They knew that this was a fraught event and violence was possible. And then violence happened, but you indicate that they just swallowed the state story whole. What do you think about this incident separates it, the media's ability to be credulous than many others that we know that they are courageous and really take a deeper look into?
Well, it's really not about even throwing the media under the bus, frankly. Think about the Pentagon Papers. Think about every courageous thing that journalists were doing at the time. This was a time of journalism, and thank God for journalists at the time. But the thing about reporting on prisons then and now is that you're talking about a narrative that this country swallowed from time immemorial, which is that if you commit a crime, you are less than human. And that particularly there has always been this association in this country between criminality and blackness. and that there is something less than human about criminals. There's something less than human about blackness, about all of this rolled together that's just kind of in ways that people don't even self-interrogate, that just seems to make sense to people when they hear about it. So you have a lot of white journalists who hear a story about black prisoners slitting the throats of white hostages, and worse yet, castrating one of them. And there is this kind of absolute believability that is, you know, it is really appalling. One that we as writers, journalists, as white America are still today hardly over, hardly have faced. And I think that's the core of it. I have no doubt that's the core of it. And to be clear, there were journalists who were troubled by it, who were appalled by it, and they got a lot of resistance from their news desks. When they did learn that they had been lied to, they went to their editors. They did push back. And to be really clear here, a lot of their editors pushed right back at them and said, yeah, well, but what did they do? What did these prisoners do? What was it? What were they in there for? What were their crimes? I mean, it was a really ugly scene in those newsrooms when the journalists tried to do the right thing.
You mentioned that these journalists did realize, some of them, that they have been lied to. It's been 50 years since this event. How did the story begin to leak out? Where did the truth start seeping from?
Well, this is also where we have to just be really clear that it was not the case that people did not know from the beginning what had happened. From the beginning, the people on the inside, the prisoners, and the people on the outside, the hostages and their families, were always telling the American public what had happened, always. And nobody wanted to hear it. So from the beginning, the story was available. And from the beginning, they were shouting it from the rooftops, but nobody wanted to hear it. In fact, the state of New York set about an investigation where they never indicted any members of law enforcement, even though all of the people that killed on the 13th were killed as a result of law enforcement bullets. They instead indicted 62 prisoners. They never fully acknowledged what they had done to the hostage families. Instead, they actually swindled them out of their ability to even sue their employers. And so it wasn't the case that we didn't know. And that means that the story seeped out from day one. It also seeped out because the coroner, an extremely brave coroner named John Edlund, told the American public within days that the hostages had been shot and that the only people who had guns were the troopers. But at every turn, the state officials tried to discredit the people telling the truth. John Edlund, the coroner, they tried to discredit him by calling him a communist, by saying that he was, you know, not a good coroner. They brought in not one, but two different coroners to try to undermine his findings, and successfully, incidentally. They tried to get funeral directors to sign affidavits to the effect that there hadn't been bullet wounds in the hostages. They tried to say that the prisoners had just been subjected to fraternity hazings, not torture. And they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of state taxpayer funds to fight the civil case of the prisoners who simply wanted justice in a civil trial. So the amount of resources that went in to try to fight the truth is staggering. And so the story was always there. It's just that nobody believed them.
In the decades since, has the state's posture changed at all?
Well, on the surface, it would appear so. For all intents and purposes, the state of New York has thousands of boxes of materials related to Attica. All of the case, years of the cases that it defended, you can't get access to them. But no, the answer is no. The Attica records remain sealed. And so no, there's never been an acknowledgement publicly that they committed harm. There's never been an apology. There's never been an acknowledgement.
Well, this brings us to you, actually. You're a professor at the University of Michigan, and you've written a book on Attica. What drew you to start researching the prison riot?
Well, it's such a bizarre story personally, because I'm a historian of civil rights and urban America, and I grew up in the city of Detroit. My first book was about the Black freedom struggle in the city of Detroit. And when I thought about what I wanted to do my next book on, I was really drawn to the story of Attica because I'd always known that there was this incredible civil rights story that had happened in a prison. And I had seen a snippet of an Eyes on the Prize documentary about it. And it had just always struck me as what an incredible story, but I knew so little about it. And I thought, I really, really want to explore this for my next book. But I am kind of embarrassed and kind of appalled at how little I knew about it and how I had no idea what I was getting myself into, no idea what I really how it would change my life. It took 13 years of my life because I didn't understand both what that book would reveal about not just the lies told at Attica and what the implications of that were for that event and how we had misunderstood it as a nation and what the implications of all that were for the survivors, which I could talk about all day. I mean, I've never in my life written about something for which the trauma was so still personally lived by so many people, but also that the implications of it for the nation in terms of the fallout on mass incarceration, it was a journey that I had never even begun to appreciate when I started it. So when I'm asked, why did I write the book? I sort of naively think, oh, because I thought it was a civil rights story behind bars. I had no idea what this story was when I started it.
You mentioned that many of the records are still held away from the public. How was your research process?
Well, again, that was the naivete. You know, historians, when they write a book, they go to archives. We go to libraries that hold these repositories of records. And so I imagined that I would figure out where all the records related to Attica were. I figured that they'd be, you know, in the state archives and they'd be in various repositories around upstate New York. And I'd go there and I'd ask for, you know, box 50, folder 20, and I'd spend a few years doing research and I'd write the book. Well, it immediately became clear to me that that was not going to work. Every time I filed a Freedom of Information request, they came back so heavily redacted, I could barely see anything. Every time I would ask for files, I'd get newspaper clippings. There was barely anything there. And that's when it dawned on me, oh no, this is not going to go well. And so I started to have to come at this project completely differently. Who had the copy? Who had the original? Kind of reinvent the archive, if you will. Try to find the survivors, see if they would talk to me, have conversations with people in their basements, in their living rooms, in coffee shops, try to reproduce, recreate what had happened. And it was just a journey. And to be really, really frank, had it not been for all of those people's graciousness to share their trauma and to be willing to go through it again, to walk through it again, I could not have written this book, number one. And number two, had it not been for a sheer set of just luck, and that's all I can say, luck. I mean, I happened upon a cache of records that the state of New York did not know was there. And had I not found that particular set of records, which subsequently was disappeared, I would not have been able to name the shooters that had been protected for 45 years. I would not have fully understood the scope of the cover-up, and I would not have been able to write the book I was able to write. And that, to me, to this day, scares me because it indicates to me kind of the depth of how serious this actually is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's certainly imaginable that there might be some records that the state didn't know about, and that you were very lucky to have found them. But it's remarkable to me that, having found them, that they would disappear, that they know you, a reputed historian and now writing a book about Attica, has found these documents, will report on them, probably has made copies of them, but the evidence goes away. What possible story could they be concocting?
Well, I actually don't even think that it's that thoughtful, diabolical, or planned. I don't even think it is a, you know, cloak and dagger story of that magnitude. I think that it is a whole lot of people just being uncertain what is in the blizzard of papers that many people have in their possession around various offices in various locations related to Attica and various circumstances around the state of New York. Nobody really understands what they have. Nobody knows who these records may point fingers to. Nobody knows really what the implications of them are. And as all bureaucracies are wont to do, nobody wants to be the one that opens that Pandora's box. There's no statute of limitations on murder, so nobody wants to be the guy, the woman who is that person that is in the vortex of that storm. So I don't even think that anybody is the mastermind behind any of this. I think people just want things to go away. So it just kind of gets, here's a box. I don't know what these records are, but you know what? I think they should go over back to the state archives, or here, I don't know what these are, but I think, you know, send them back to the AG's office. And I think in this case, these records, the more I kind of pieced it together, I think these were records that were in the chambers of the chief judge that was overseeing the Attica criminal trials. He passed away. And I think that they were all just put in storage in the courthouse. I think that there'd been some damage or something, maybe some water damage. They got put in the storage room. I was allowed to see them. And by accident, I say, because I think the person who allowed me to see them just thought, oh, yeah, we got some Attica records back there. Sure, go ahead and look at them. And I think that eventually, you know, they thought, oh, dear, you know, we got all these Attica records. Not a good idea. We should probably send them back off to where they needed to go. But the point is, once they end up back where they, quote unquote, need to go, you're never going to see them again. And so I don't know the mechanism, I don't know the reason, but what I do know is that there's a whole lot of people who are very, very scared of what the implications of them are, even though they're not quite sure why. And the upshot of it is that no one wants to be the person that opens that Pandora's box. I do want to be very clear that the state police are, in fact, very concerned, remain very concerned about those records. And they do actively stand up and block any attempt to open the records, any attempt to unseal. There's something called the Meyer Report that actually investigated the Attica investigation. The state police union is actively always trying to block access to the Attica records. So I do think it is important to distinguish between what random clerks and records officers and indeed even elected officials in the state of New York, how they feel about opening the Attica records. I think many of them would be perfectly happy to do it. I think they're a little nervous about what the fallout might be for their career or what these records may in fact indicate. But I don't think that there's a high stakes anymore in keeping them closed for most people in the state of New York, elected official or otherwise. But I do think it's really important to understand that the New York State Police are still very, very actively invested in keeping those records sealed. And that should not be allowed because they were party to the trauma in that event at that time. And the state, as the representatives of all the people in the New York, including those who were incarcerated, should not bow simply to the wishes of the one party that committed the trauma there.
So 50 years on, there is still something about the events at Attica that caused consternation for the state. What is it? What is the legacy of Attica for us now?
Well, I think that one of the things that we need to remember about Attica is that it has a dual legacy. On the one hand, Attica's legacy is extraordinary repression. But on the other hand, the other legacy of Attica is this kind of certain knowledge that no matter how many people you put behind bars and no matter how you treat them, inevitably, when you put human beings behind bars, they are going to remain human beings. And they eventually and powerfully and inevitably will stand up and they will demand to be treated as human beings. And so today we are seeing that piece of it.
Heather Ann Thompson, thank you so much for talking to me today on American Scandal.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was my conversation with Heather Ann Thompson, a professor at the University of Michigan and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Blood in the Water. Next on American Scandal. In the mid-2010s, Theranos was one of the hottest companies in Silicon Valley. Founded by the young entrepreneur Elizabeth Holmes, Theranos worked to pioneer a revolutionary technology for testing blood. Holmes was attempting to transform medicine, and seemingly overnight, she became a billionaire and a celebrity. But when a reporter began to dig around, he uncovered a series of lies that would threaten Holmes and her budding empire. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to American Scandal ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is Episode 5 of the Attica Prison Uprising for American Scandal. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Music by Lindsey Graham. Our senior producer is Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect forever.